Al Jazeera Podcasts.
Rafah in southern Gaza, the last refuge for 1.5 million Palestinians sheltering in fear of an Israeli ground invasion. The US and European allies are all opposed, so will Israel push ahead regardless, and what would be the consequences? I'm James Bayes, and you're listening to the Inside Story podcast, where we dissect, analyse, and help define major global stories. Well, now let's discuss this with our guests today. Khulod Jouafil is in Deir al-Balad in central Gaza. She's an economic justice officer at Oxfam, who specialises in supporting women-led businesses and youth entrepreneurship. In Durham in the UK, Robert Geist-Pinfold, a lecturer in peace and security at Durham University. His research focuses on Israeli foreign and security policy. And Hisham Mahana is actually in the city of Rafah. He's the spokesman in Gaza for the International Committee of the Red Cross. Glad to have you all with us. So let me start with you, Hisham. You are there in Rafah, and your organisation is the guardians of the rules of war, the Geneva Convention. So tell me, what does international humanitarian law say about the possibility of a large-scale military offensive in a place that's so packed with people?
Hello, James, and thank you for having me. The rules of war are very clear. Civilian lives and infrastructure must be protected, no matter what happens. And from what we have been witnessing in Rafah, with the large waves of displacement that have been ongoing for months, and many families have been on the move and been displaced for an average of 5 times per family. Now, they face the imminent reality of a military operation in Rafah, and the ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross, have warned the international community and parties of the conflict that any possible scenario of a massive military operation in Rafah, given the situation of the densely populated areas here, it will be nothing but carnage.
And just to be clear for us, what is the noise that we're hearing above you? I'm assuming that's a drone.
That is correct. This is what people in Rafah and in different areas across the Gaza Strip hear most of the day.
Khulod, tell us more about the life of ordinary people in Rafah and elsewhere in Gaza. You represent Oxfam, but I know you are a mother of a young child yourself. How difficult is things right now?
Thank you for hosting me today and for this program. And thank you for always giving attention to Gaza, because eyes should always be on Gaza. The situation is really devastating. The humanitarian situation is still very difficult. No enough aid enter Gaza, despite the international calls from the organizations and humanitarian organization to scale up aid that enter Gaza. Still, the situation is very devastating. Everyone here is afraid of any expected military operation in Rafah, because this for sure will put the humanitarian situation in a more difficult situation. Rafah is very crowded of civilians. Rafah is really crowded of tents, of makeshift camps, where people are trying to find safe shelter there. So any military offensive on Rafah will really make things more difficult. We don't expect to have a real actually evacuation of civilians from Rafah, but what we really expect that the humanitarian situation will get more difficult, because we expect a closure of border, and we only have one line open, which is Rafah crossing border. And despite this, the aid that enter Gaza is not enough. It's not enough to respond to the needs of those internally displaced people and persons here in Gaza Strip. And for sure, as a mom, on my personal level, it's really hard whenever we hear about any expected military operations in any area, not only Rafah, but also in Middle area or any area in the Gaza Strip. It's always put us in a situation where we cannot really find any safety anywhere.
Robert, is it a case of if there is a Rafah offensive or when there is a Rafah offensive? Because Prime Minister Netanyahu, still talking about total victory, he says a date's already been set, although he hasn't told us what it is, of course.
Well, this is the question on everyone's minds. Netanyahu himself has been talking about a Rafah offensive for a very, very long time now, and nothing has materialised. Had you asked me this a week and a half or 2 weeks ago, I would have said to you that this is all basically a bluff, that Netanyahu is trying to use this as leverage in the talks in Qatar to try and basically reach an agreement with Hamas that would see the return of hostages and some kind of a temporary or lasting ceasefire. Now, the exchange between Israel and Iran that took place subsequently is a game changer and leaves this an open question. Why? Well, because Netanyahu's retaliation, Israel's retaliation against that Iranian attack was relatively light. Basically, one anti-aircraft defense system was destroyed from what we can tell so far. That was basically, it didn't reach a threshold to isolate Israel from its international partners who've been arguing against a de-escalation. The problem Netanyahu now has is an internal one. Having appeased his international partners, he has annoyed the far-right members of his coalition on whom he's reliant for his survival. You had National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir tweeting on X very soon after the attack, one word that loosely translates to weak or pathetic in Hebrew. So Netanyahu is now under pressure to demonstrate his hawkish credentials and to appease his coalition allies. So I think the danger of a Rafah offensive is now more substantial than we've had for a very long time in the previous weeks.
Hisham, your organisation, the ICRC, we mentioned how it governs the laws of war, but it's also a humanitarian organisation. What would it mean if an offensive was carried out in Rafah, given that this is, I believe, normally about 270,000 people, and now there are about 1.5 million. The place is completely swelled. Tell us a bit about the humanitarian situation on the ground. And if I can add a second part to my question, Rafah is very limited aid coming into Gaza, but is one of the entry points for aid. That makes it even worse, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Now, considering that there is approximately 1.3 million people living on 20% only of the total space of the Gaza Strip, totally disconnected from the basic services, and for example, 900 people have only access to one latrine, and an average person in Rafah has access to only 3 liters of water per day. Two of them are not suitable for human consumption, and this is the basic examples of how people suffer under inhumane conditions as a result of the ongoing conflict. Now, there are several challenges that are facing humanitarian workers, including the International Committee of the Red Cross, which is the lack of or absence of security guarantees that are crucial and necessary for achieving a meaningful humanitarian response on the ground. Despite all that, we are trying to maximize our humanitarian response. However, this will not change the reality on the ground as long as there are hostilities on the ground and they are not ceased anytime soon. The situation worsens by the clock, by the hour, and there is already a limited space for humanitarian workers to work. Now, if things escalate further in Rafah crossing, this humanitarian space will shrink even more and more, making any possible humanitarian response definitely meaningless on the ground. We are trying as hard as possible, but this is not an environment that humanitarians can work, achieve their objectives.
I'm going to move on, actually, and ask Khalid a follow-up question now. If there was a Rafah offensive, where would the people go?
Actually, nowhere. And this is the question that we hear every day from anyone living in Gaza. Like, if there is any offensive operation and military operation in any area in the Gaza Strip, where to go? And actually, people have no place to go. Each one of those Gazan people at least has been displaced for at least one or two times through this war. And till this moment, we don't have like safe shelters to host those IDPs in the Gaza Strip. If there is any expected offensive military operation in Rafah, people will find nowhere to go, and the situation
so, Khalid,
will
is there a possibility? Is there a possibility, Khalid, which I've heard some say, that people might be forced out of the Gaza Strip? Is that a possibility?
We have been hearing about this since the beginning of the war, but what I think is that people in Gaza will not actually find this solution is really good for them to leave Gaza. People here have left their houses in North Gaza and in Gaza. Until this moment, they wait every day in order to listen about any news or to learn about any updates and negotiations that are being done in Qatar and Egypt and everywhere in order to hear about the possibility to return to their houses. Leaving Gaza forcibly is not easy for those people, actually.
And if we talk about being on the edge of the Gaza Strip, and this is the southern point of the Gaza Strip, Robert, it's on the edge of Egyptian territory. And of course, Egypt remains a country with a peace treaty with Israel. What do you think Egypt is making of the prospect of this offensive?
Well, Egypt is very much against this offensive taking place. And this is exactly why the Biden administration is now exerting so much pressure, because they're getting pressure from their partners in the Arab world, countries like Egypt and Saudi Arabia and others, to pressure Israel to reach a ceasefire as soon as possible. For Egypt, as you say, there is a border issue here as well, that Egypt explicitly has ruled out the resettling of Palestinians refugees within the Sinai Peninsula. Instead, there's been all sorts of talk about Israel, for example, trying to resettle them elsewhere. But this is a key point of friction between the Biden administration and the Israeli government. Israel maintains, from what we've heard from leaks, that resettling all of the 1.5, give or take, civilians within Rafah will take them around 4 weeks. The US disagrees vehemently and thinks this will take around 4 months. And actually, doing something like what Israel proposes, this mass, very rapid resettlement to avoid a humanitarian crisis, will actually only make a humanitarian crisis more likely and significantly worse, because you will be moving people without infrastructure, without planning. You'll be moving them at a very, very very unplanned way. And as some of my colleagues here have mentioned, these are people who've been uprooted on multiple occasions. So all of those risks of famine and disease would actually be exacerbated by a rapid, unplanned evacuation.
So pick up on that point, if you can, Hisham. I mean, legally, under international humanitarian law, is there a way Israel could do this, or does it amount to forced displacement, which is in itself illegal under international law?
Well, this is entirely our responsibility on parties to the conflict. Israel, as an occupying power in Gaza, must ensure the protection of civilians, and they have absolute access to everything necessary for their own survival, including food, water, hygiene, and healthcare. And in terms of displacement, people must be assured that they can be moved safely from one area to another, that families, one family cannot or does not get separated from their beloved ones, and it has to be timely bound, that they cannot be displaced forever. It's now more important than ever that the international community must be held upon responsibilities to exert more pressure to put this bloodshed to an end. And there's no way that people in Gaza can continue living like this. It has been almost 200 days now, and they have been through a lot.
Khalid, we've got lots of comments from members of the international community who are telling Israel not to carry out a Rafah operation. The UN Secretary General said an operation in Rafah would compound the humanitarian catastrophe. The US Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, said there would be terrible consequences for civilians. How seriously do people there in Gaza take these comments from these international figures when the war now is coming up to its seventh month? And yes, you've got the US warning of this, but at the same time, the US giving $26 billion in the last few days to Israel.
People in Gaza actually fed up listening to to the external world's declarations and comments on social media about any expected military operation in Rafah. because what do they really suffer is the reality. The reality is that the devastating humanitarian situation, infrastructure is damaged, houses, buildings is damaged, are damaged, no access to clean water to drink, no access to domestic water to be used, no access to enough food. The health system is really collapsed. So people are living in tent. Now we are in summer. So people are being burned, actually, inside those tents. So people are only thinking about the reality, about what they are suffering from. They try to hear some news between times and another, but they actually fear. They actually fear an expected military operation because, as you have mentioned, they don't have any place to go. They have nowhere. There is no safe shelters in Gaza. Even El Mawasi, even any place, no place in Gaza is safe because people have already experiences with being displaced from one place to another place.
Robert, we've heard tough words from the Biden administration before towards the Netanyahu government, and Netanyahu really hasn't listened on many occasions. But it is worth noting there is another development in the last few hours. It looks like the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, is going to sanction, under what's known as the Leahy Laws, one particular unit of the Israeli military. Do you think that will get Israel's attention? It's not related to the possibility of a offensive in Rafah, but do you think it could become linked?
Yeah, just to give some context for your viewers, what we're talking about here is the Netzach Yehuda Battalion. Now, this was a pioneering battalion set up by the IDF leadership because it specifically seeks to integrate strictly Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox Israelis into the army, many of whom wouldn't normally serve in the military. So it's a strictly religious unit. Now, the problem here is that this unit has been subject to significant and building allegations of human rights abuses long before the current military campaign, including the death of a 78-year-old Palestinian-American in 2022, who was basically abducted by the group and left to die. So the Israeli government will say, look, there's no truth to these allegations, but we do know that that battalion was moved out of the West Bank and onto the quieter Golan Heights border. Whether there's a connection there is very much an open question, but it is now fighting in the Gaza Strip and is part of the military operations at the moment. Will this affect Israel's military behaviour in its campaign? No, we're talking about 1,000 people here. This is not a significant sanction, but Israel's leaders are indeed incensed by this. They argue it's the thin end of a wedge, and who knows what this opens up, and it is indeed a new precedent. So on the one hand, you have Biden is basically trying to use carrot and stick here. On the one hand, you have that $26 billion aid package that was used to support Israel and show US support for Israel. On the other hand, you have new precedents like the sanctioning of members of the IDF. So is this an act in itself that will be a game changer? No. But is it the start of increased US public pressure against Israel? I'd argue yes.
Hisham, let me take you back to where you are, where we're talking about, that overcrowded city of Rafah. Now, one of the things we've seen in over 6 months is the collapse of the medical system across the Gaza Strip. And we saw that hospitals were deliberately targeted by Israel. Al-Shifa in Gaza City, Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, the most well-known, but so many hospitals targeted. How worried are you about the hospitals where you are in Rafah if they were to face the same thing? Because they seem to be among the only functioning medical facilities in the whole Gaza Strip now.
The International Committee of the Red Cross have warned since the start, the early stage of this conflict, about impacting the healthcare system in Gaza, which has been heavily impacted by 16 years long of restrictions on the movement of people and goods. And after hospitals have come to rubble following the military operations conducted inside these hospitals and around them, it leaves only, the entire healthcare system in Gaza now is collapsed. And there's only one hospital that is capable of providing advanced healthcare service, and that is the Gaza European Hospital in the governorate of Khan Yunis, where a surgical team of the ICRC doctors and nurses and surgeons work since last November and deliver perform an average of 20 urgently needed surgeries on a daily basis. The ICRC is at its most priority to keep providing support to whatever is left from the healthcare system in Gaza Strip. But there is no health entity that can absorb the influx of patients, either in Rafah or in Khan Yunis, if the scenario of a military operation is conducted. Hospitals have been reeling and doctors have been working non-stop for 6 months. The entire healthcare system in Gaza, or whatever is left of it, is on its knees. Doctors themselves and medical staff have either been killed, detained, or lost a dear friend or something that is valuable in their lives, yet they continue to work. However, they cannot continue working like this forever.
I mean, Khalid, let me show our viewers something that I think demonstrates this. These are pictures of a young baby in Rafah. The baby was saved from the womb of her mother, who was dying from head injuries, and an emergency cesarean section was performed in Rafah. The woman died, as did her husband, as did their three-year-old other daughter. It just shows the appalling situation facing women and children in Gaza, does it not? A shocking statistic I saw from UNICEF. Every 10 minutes, one child is killed or injured in Gaza.
We have actually million of such tragedy stories in the Gaza Strip, and always, and like any conflict around the world, women and children always pay the highest price. And during this war, a very big number of women and children were killed, actually, with no limited danger and risky things. The children all the time, they are at risk, they are at danger, they are fear, they shout whenever they hear any pumping or shelling around them. For my son, for example, all the time I'm trying to keep him calm, trying to convince him that there is nothing risky around us. But the reality is that our children couldn't actually grow up in an environment like this. Children need to grow up in a protective environment, safety environment. And the story of that baby actually in Rafah is one of million of stories that happened in the Gaza Strip during this escalation. And it was really tragedy seeing that how life is born out of death. And it's really difficult to see and to think about how would the future of this baby will be without his mother, his father, siblings, and with this really tragic story.
Staying with you, Khalid, and not as an official from Oxfam, but as a mother, what would be your message to leaders around the world who have power here? What would be your message to the Israeli leaders at this moment as they contemplate a full-on offensive into Rafah?
My message is really having any military operation in Rafah will actually put civilians in a very devastating situation. Civilians should be protected. That's why I call on a personal level as a mom, I call for an immediate permanent ceasefire, because every minute passed in Gaza, we lose. We lose people, we lose our loved ones, we lose our family members, we lose our friends, colleagues, and everyone we know in Gaza. So an immediate permanent ceasefire for sure will end this, because this actually should end. This fear, this loss should be end in Gaza now.
Okay, thank you very much to our three guests today, Khalid Jouafil, Rob Geist-Pinfold and Hisham Mahana. This episode was produced by Dermot Fleming, Fintan Monaghan, Veronica Pedroza and Gemma Harries. Studio sound was by Aston Goodison. The programme was edited by Alexander Otisevich, Zain Abada and Joe DeFrias. Be sure to subscribe to the Inside Story podcast to catch every episode. Thanks very much for listening, and tune in on Tuesday for our next edition.
Coming up on The Take, new and expecting mothers navigate an increasingly treacherous war zone. That's The Take by Al Jazeera. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.